Hello. So I also want to start by thanking the organization for the invitation. And I was really thankful for the invitation because being here has been a wonderful experience, meeting with all the people, with all the teachers, with all the scholars. And so it's been a wonderful experience. And it hasn't finished, so we still have more to go. I'm going to talk about, in examining the past, a particular experience that happened in Brazil in a not so distant past, actually, and the experience of the citizen school project in the city of Porto Alegre in Brazil. And what I'm going to talk about is to give you an idea of how this particular project was created. And what I'm trying to say here is that I think there's a lot to be learned by the context, the particular context where this particular experience happened. And so my take on, I'm the only non-historian in the panel, so my take on this is that we have a lot to learn from this particular experience and the particular history in which this experience is embedded. And I think this is really part of the conversation that we're trying to establish here. Learning from the past means imagining the future as well. So I'm just setting the time here so I don't run more than I need. Yesterday in the workshop, I actually presented in detail the proposal of the Citizen School Project. But I'm going to give you just some ideas here. The idea was initiated in the city of Porto Alegre. And I'm going to tell you the history of how this came about. But it's important to you to know that this was a coalition of left-wing parties led by the Workers' Party of Brazil that won the election, the municipal elections, only the second election after the military dictatorship in Brazil in 1989, and then governed the city for 16 years, were re-elected three times. And the educational project that I'm going to talk about was just one part of the project for actually transforming the space of the city and transforming the way the city dealt with the most impoverished areas and the most impoverished citizens of that city. Porto Alegre is the place where participatory budgeting started. You probably heard about it. It's the idea of giving the opportunity for the citizens to vote on the areas that they want to invest the money of the city rather than only having experts deciding that. And the educational project that was created was done in a way that I think it's very interesting to examine, because most of the times when you have reforms in education, yesterday I was talking about that, the idea of democratization of processes in education, we think about being democratic in the implementation of the process. So when I say we, it's very interesting because it's we, right? A group of intellectuals get together and sit and come with a plan, and then we say, okay, let's be democratic now to implement that. And the idea was, in this particular experience, and you will see why this came about, the idea was to define the principles themselves, the principles of what they wanted to achieve by the larger community of people in the schools, so teachers, parents, community organizers, students, staff, which are usually not included in these kinds of discussions. So this was a very important part of the reform there. After 18 long months of discussions in schools, they came up with three basic principles of democratization. And the idea was to first democratize access, because this was a city where a lot of the peripheral areas where the poorest of the poor lived had no schools. So the idea of having access was crucial. Having schools built in that particular communities were really important. The second aspect was the democratization of governing and governance structures. And this was crucial as well, because they readily identified that without changing the structures and the mechanisms where decisions are made in education and inside schools, you couldn't make democratic experiences happen. And third, which was really important as well, was democratizing knowledge and understanding what knowledge is. So rather than just having the usual idea of redistributing knowledge, that we all know what it is, it was the idea of discussing what really knowledge is and what counts as real knowledge. Right, and so this was really important. But rather than just going on the detail, I want to talk about the larger ideas, because this can connect with the previous presentations. And I want to continue talking about utopia. So Kathy ended up with utopia, and I'm going to start and then finish again with the idea of utopias. And I think Zizek is a very controversial person, but I think when he talks about utopia, he has an interesting point that I think we have to take. And the idea is, for him, utopia is as much about the past as it is about the future. Because if we don't understand the conditions in which utopia can be enacted, we really cannot enact utopia. And I really like this idea of utopia not being a free imagination, utopia being a matter of urgency. It's not an option not to be utopian. And I claim that the case of Porto Alegre is a very good example of that, where there were no alternatives for these very poor communities. They had to be utopian. They had to create the spaces for new schools, and this was part of the experience. And I think if we take the current for quite some time now, ideas about neoliberalism, and I don't want to take the economic neoliberalism has been challenged even by the very conservative economists and capitalists themselves. But I think even though the success of neoliberalism has mixed results in economy, even from a very capitalist point of view, the results in culture have been much more permanent, I think. And I think neoliberalism has been changing common sense in a way that is very important to notice. And it has to do, and I bring this because I think we have to talk about these changes in common sense when we talk about what will be my last point here about neoliberalism, which is the obliteration of our imagination in a way. So these are only like ideas that I think are important, thinking about what some of the consequences of neoliberalism, think about the whole idea of the relationships of power shift into issues of management of resources and blaming the victims because they made the wrong decisions, the depolitization of the social, the demonization of the public, you know. And particularly the recontextualization of categories. So same words that were used before neoliberalism are reconnected. Their content is recontextualized, or as Stuart Hall would say, rearticulated to different ideas. And I think this is very important. And of course, they first have to be clean of their previous content. My main point here is that the change in neoliberalism has to do with our obliteration of our memory and the history of previous mobilizations. So I don't have to go far to talk about this. Kathy just showed us many examples of very progressive educational experiences that most people don't know about, that most people don't even think that were possible in periods. So people, we tend to forget about those experiences of mobilizations, and they are disconnected in a way from the experiences of the communities themselves. And so if we are to think about the future, we do necessarily need to connect with the past. And the idea of restoring this history of mobilizations is crucial. And understanding this particular example of the citizen school, I think, presents us with a very interesting case of how it's possible to reconnect with the history of mobilizations. So it's important to understand, in that particular example that I'm giving you, that Brazil had many dictatorships, but the latest dictatorship, military dictatorship, was from 64 to 85. And during that dictatorship, political parties were banned, and then they were recreated in a sort of farcical way. And unions were highly controlled. And through those gaps, right, so no more open space politics were happening, you know, and of course there was a lot of continuous mobilizations in the shadows, as I say. But a lot of very small and very sort of unarticulated mobilizations started to happen in Brazil. And in the case of Porto Alegre, there are very interesting examples. One were mobilization of this mothers that started confronting the government about the cost of living. And so they would gather together and go in front of grocery stores, supermarkets, and start protesting. And that was not seen by the political parties or the unions as real politics. They were just, you know, women protesting. And also, there was this particular moment in all Latin America and Central America as well. There were these mobilizations from this Catholic ecclesial-based communities happening, which were based on theology of liberation and the connections with Marxism. And this very small communities meeting at the church or sometimes at a community center would gather together and talk about their own lives and develop a known method of analyzing the reality. So we have this interesting mobilizations happening that I think are crucial to understand why the experience of Porto Alegre and the citizen school project later on had like a fertile ground for it to happen. And there was this idea of resisting the old vanguard structures of, for example, the communist parties in Brazil, where, you know, you would the communist party, the official communist party in Brazil, was at this point sort of almost in favor of the dictatorship, because they envisioned that, you know, if capitalism keeps its course, then communism will come eventually, so it will be a good thing, right? So these people were doing quite the opposite. They were saying, no, this is not the way to go. We need more collective organizations. And this was very fertile ground for a lot of things happening. And eventually, these methods and their organization started influencing the creation of, new unions, but also the creation of the Workers' Party in Brazil, which came from this tradition of very different traditions of the left. But also one of the largest, and I think it's still the largest, teachers' unions in South America, which is the teachers' unions of the state of Rio Grande do Sul, of which Porto Alegre is the capital. So this is really crucial, because when in 1989 the election was won by the Workers' Party, the people who were called upon to run the educational department were all people from this, that had that, those traditions of living in those environments of very sort of democratic decisions about what to do, and very bottom-up decisions, and these kinds of things. And they were the ones who organized the Citizen School Project. And I think this has this tells a lot about why this particular experience happened in this particular place, right? And this had the capacity to infusing the tradition of democratic governance in education in this particular school system in the south of Brazil. They, in a way, provided the spaces, the social movements, also for when communities were invited to participate in the decisions on curriculum and on the way schools should be built or not, and how they should participate or not in the decisions about budgets and these kinds of things, that history of mobilizations provided a fertile ground for that to happen. It's not that people already knew everything, how to participate. Many people in these very poor communities were actually not living in Porto Alegre during the dictatorship, for example. They are all newcomers to the city, so there was a learning curve as well there. But there was this new environment of participation that was being invited. And I think there are some lessons here to be learned. And I think in the case of Porto Alegre, there are interesting lessons. I think one of them is, Kathy talked about that in a way, about the connection of, if change will come, it will come from the connections of communities and schools. And very early on, I think the organizers of the project realized that. They understood that they had to change the way education is done to the poor. Education for the poor has a tradition of being a deficit-filling education, right? So we locate deficit in the poor, and we give them what they lack, right? They don't have this, they don't have that, so we give them that. The based on a very Paulo Freirean experience, they realized very soon that there was a very important role that schools could play, and schools could provide very powerful knowledge for these communities, but this knowledge had to be connected to the problems that these communities identify as their own problems. And also, this couldn't be done by denying their own knowledge as proper knowledge. So in a very Freirean tradition, they combine this idea of a more traditional knowledge and popular knowledge as important for transformations to happen. In a way, it was almost like trying to empower these kids to be bilingual, to work in these two environments with and transitioning well in both of these environments. So I already said that I'm a mere distributive model that takes knowledge as something for granted and gives it back to the poor in this particular context cannot be done if you really want to achieve what Ray Winconnell calls curricular justice, which is thinking about curriculum in terms of its connections to which perspective is being taken here. And also, I think another lesson important there is the fact that once you do institutional change, once you do the change of mechanisms in the schools, you cannot just sit and relax and say all is good, right? Because what happened in many of the schools is that even with new mechanisms, with mechanisms that allowed for kids to, you know, flex in a more flexible way and not to be, you know, have failures year after year like the usual Brazilian system was happening, that those new mechanisms can be ossified as well. So they need to be re-examined. You need to have structures that allow for these discussions to happen. So I started with utopia and I finish with utopia. And I think we live in a time where the conversation around education is very much framed by a discussion of finding good methods, and because it's almost like we all are in agreement of what has to be taught. And what I think Zizek is saying here is that thinking in a utopian way is not necessarily being a dreamer, but it's actually enacting. If there is a future, this future has to be utopian. The current conditions in which the kinds of questions that are being asked in education only provide a certain kind of responses, right? So I told yesterday that the newspaper, the local newspaper of the city where I live, says have a campaign, educational campaign that says education needs answers. And the other day I was questioning that idea. I said, yes, education does necessarily needs answers, but not for the kinds of questions that are being asked. We need new questions. And of course, for these new questions, we need new answers. And I would agree with Zizek, if those are not utopian questions, they're not probably worth asking them. Thank you.